This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, in this portion of the program, an armchair tour of the heavens. Astronomer Ken Croswell is our guest. His latest book is Magnificent Universe. It takes readers on a tour of the planets, the stars, the galaxies, and the universe through clear prose and fabulous photographs from observatories around the world and spacecraft, including the Hubble Space Telescope. Publishers Weekly says Magnificent Universe, quoting here, shows rather than tells readers why some kids grow up to be astronomers. Questions for our guest, Ken Croswell, are encouraged. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Ken Croswell earned his Ph.D. in astronomy from Harvard University. He is the author of two previous books, The Alchemy of the Heavens and Planet Quest. Both books met with great acclaim. And he spoke with us about Planet Quest 2 years ago here on the Afternoon Magazine. So this afternoon, we're happy to welcome him back. Ken Croswell, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How
Glad
are
to be
you?
Here.
Good. Nice to talk with you again. Let's talk about the Hubble Space Telescope. How many photographs has it taken now? It's been out there for almost a decade.
Well, it's taken lots of photographs, and it's really improved our knowledge of the universe, especially the distance scale of the universe, better determining how fast the universe is expanding. And in Magnificent Universe, actually, the cover photograph, the first photograph you see, is from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's actually a close-up view of a star-forming region in another galaxy, the spiral galaxy M33. And there are, of course, many other photographs in Magnificent Universe from the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah. They're so beautiful. When did you see the first images from the telescope, and how did viewing those images make you feel?
Well, the very first images from the Hubble Space Telescope weren't all that good because, as you know, it went up in 1990, mm-hmm. and it had this very embarrassing defect with its mirror. So mm-hmm. the very first images from the Hubble, in fact, for several years, weren't terribly spectacular. It was only in late 1993 that the Hubble Space Telescope was repaired via the space shuttle. And since then, we've gotten some really great data and some really great photographs. And in fact, nearly all the photographs in Magnificent Universe from the Hubble Space Telescope date from after that repair mission. So, for example, that cover photograph you're looking at comes from after the repair mission.
Yeah. Now, another repair mission is about to lift off.
Yes, this one is perhaps even more critical because, as you probably know, for the last several weeks, the Hubble Space Telescope has actually been shut down. The Hubble Space Telescope stabilizes itself by using gyroscopes. These orient the telescope in space, and it needs three gyroscopes in order to orient itself. It actually has six. The problem is four of those six have broken, so there are only two left, and two gyroscopes are just not enough to do the job. And so this upcoming shuttle mission is very vital for the Hubble Space Telescope and for anyone who wants to see results from the Hubble Space Telescope, because at the moment, the telescope is just not taking any new data.
Yeah. Well, these gyroscopes then are critical to the functioning of the telescope. Maybe you would tell us something about how the telescope operates.
Well, basically, it has to point at various objects that it wants to photograph. For example, if it wants to look at two colliding spiral galaxies, it needs to point in exactly the right direction to do that. Or if it wants to take a photograph, for example, the very famous photograph of those star pillars that came out in 1995, it has to point at exactly the right spot in the sky. And in order to do that, it has to stabilize itself through using these gyroscopes. And so with only two gyroscopes, that's just not enough for the telescope to stabilize itself. And so this shuttle mission is absolutely critical. If those gyroscopes aren't replaced, mm-hmm. then the Hubble Space Telescope is basically dead in the water, even though all the other instrumentation is working just fine. It's just that it can't point to the right place in the sky without those gyroscopes.
Yeah, it's sort of like the inner ear of the telescope.
You know, yeah, actually, that's in a... that's a nice analogy. All the rest of your body may be working just fine, but if your inner ear isn't functioning,
you're in
you
trouble.
May be destabilized.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that the Hubble has given us a lot of information about the universe and its expansion and the rate at which it is expanding. What's the latest thinking on that now, about the expansion of the universe?
Yes, we've known ever since the 1920s that the universe is expanding, that new space is being created. It's actually opening up between us and most other galaxies, and is actually pushing those other galaxies away from us. That, of course, was the great discovery that Edwin Hubble, not the telescope, but the man, made back in 1929. Since then, there has been a huge struggle to determine just how fast the universe is expanding. And one reason that this is absolutely crucial is because it affects our estimates for the age of the universe. If the universe is expanding very fast, then that means that the universe is young, because a fast-expanding universe has not taken much time to reach its present size from the Big Bang. Whereas if the universe is expanding much more slowly, then the universe is older, because a slowly expanding universe has taken a fair amount of time to reach its present size. And with the Hubble Space Telescope, scientists have narrowed down the range over the expansion rate of the universe. And so we actually have now a better estimate for the expansion rate and therefore for the age of the universe. And that age comes out to be maybe somewhere between 10 and 15 billion years. And of course, we hope to do even better in the future.
Yeah. Now, NASA estimates the universe is 12 billion years old, and then there's an astronomer by the name of Alan Sandage who thinks it's older, 15 billion years. How is it that these two camps come up with, you know, a fairly, you know, 3 billion years is a pretty big spread?
Yes.
How is it that they come up with such different answers?
It's basically because they're getting different values for the expansion rate of the universe. The Hubble Space Telescope team from NASA finds a higher expansion rate than does Alan Sandage, who finds a much lower expansion rate. And so therefore, the NASA team gets a younger age, and Alan Sandage gets an older age. And I've looked at both teams' data. I don't really know who's doing it right and who's doing it wrong. It's basically, see, in order to measure the expansion rate, what you need to do two things. You need to measure the velocities at which galaxies are moving away from you. That's very easy to do. You can just, it comes about just by the redshift. You just measure the galaxy's redshift, and there you've got it. What's much more difficult is then measuring the distance of those various galaxies. And the expansion rate is just the velocity divided by the distance. We know the velocities. We don't know the distances terribly well. And the reason that there is so much contention between that NASA team and between Alan Sandage is because they reach different conclusions concerning the distances of those galaxies. And therefore, they get different values for the expansion rate of the universe.
Mm. You just used a term that I think I'd like you to explain to us, measuring the redshift.
Yes, indeed. The redshift is something that arises from the expansion of space itself. As light from a distant galaxy travels through space, that space actually expands and stretches the wavelength of the light. And a longer wavelength, it has a redder color, and so therefore we call that a redshift. And the longer the light has traveled through the expanding space, i.e. the farther the galaxy is from us, the greater that light is going to get stretched and redshifted. Therefore, the farther the galaxy, the greater is the redshift. And that was the great discovery of Edwin Hubble that he reported back in 1929, that farther galaxies have greater redshifts because the entire universe is expanding as space opens up between them and us.
Fascinating. Also out there, an observatory that was launched recently called Chandra. Would you tell us about that satellite?
Yes, this is another great observatory in space, whereas the Hubble Space Telescope observes primarily visible light. The Chandra observes light that is invisible, namely X-rays. X-rays have much higher energy and much shorter wavelength than normal light. And so Chandra is sort of doing to the X-ray sources in the sky what the Hubble Space Telescope has done with those objects that emit visible light. And X-ray observations tell us more about the universe than than we would know simply from optical measurements.
Yeah, and this satellite's been up there since summer. Has it provided us with anything that's been breathtaking so far?
Well, it's taken a nice photograph, for example, of the Crab Nebula. The Crab Nebula is it's basically the remains of a star that exploded about 1,000 years ago in the constellation Taurus. And it's showed us close-up views of that object. X-rays indicate the presence of, you know, very high-energy stuff, particles and so forth. And, of course, when a supernova blows up, you're going to have a lot of high-energy material. And so, therefore, X-ray observations are a very good idea for studying supernova remnants like the Crab Nebula.
Yeah.
But the Chandra is a fairly new satellite, so it hasn't, you know, it hasn't made the number of discoveries that Hubble has made. I mean, Hubble's been up there since 1990, and you know, in really good condition, it's been up there since late 1993. So Hubble, of course, has made a lot more discoveries than Chandra. But you know, give Chandra time, and I think you'll be seeing a lot more discoveries from it too.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk with a caller, a listener on line one in Mahomet. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Fascinating topic. I was wondering if you were familiar with the work that the Beckman Institute was doing with, in terms of the Sloan project that was surveying for the redshift, by any chance?
Yes, there's a huge project underway to basically map a lot of the galaxies and determine the redshifts and sort of get a better three-dimensional view of the entire universe, to map as much of the observable universe as they can. You see, when we look at the sky and we see a galaxy, we sort of know where it is relative to Earth, but we don't know how far it is. And the redshift is really what tells you that, because in general, the greater the redshift, the farther is the galaxy. And so what they're doing is measuring redshifts of, you know, tons of galaxies out there, and they're going to be looking for things like clusters and superclusters.
This is an application of the supercomputer capacity and the grid, too, right? Is that right?
Well, I'm sure they're using computers to analyze the data, yeah, yeah.
Well, this guy, I was privileged to listen to a lecture there on Tuesday by the director of the Institute. He took his laptop computer and projected a, well, for lack of what they looked like was George Lucas's Star Wars type beginning, but much more complicated, and it apparently was reading intergravitational effects, or at least it was simulating intergravitational effects based on Planck's constant and all sorts of other equations. So supercomputers are a big part of trying to crunch the numbers that you're dealing with through Hubble, too, huh?
Yeah, well, certainly you need, yeah, I mean, there's so much data, and it's, you know, you definitely need computers to do this data analysis, absolutely, yes.
Well, thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other phone calls are welcome for our guest this afternoon, astronomer Ken Croswell. His latest book is Magnificent Universe. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Well, let's go back to Chandra for a moment, if we might. What might this satellite observatory be able to tell us about black holes?
Well, black holes are really crucial, or there's a really crucial link between black holes and X-ray observations. Chandra, of course, will be making its observations in the X-ray band. Maybe we should back up and define, I should define what a black hole is and then explain how on earth we can discover these objects when no one can see them.
Right.
I mean, a black hole is simply a star that has collapsed so much that its gravity, its surface gravity is so intense that nothing can escape from it, not even light, the fastest thing in the universe. And so once you fall into a black hole, you can't get out again. And even if you wanted to dive into a black hole to tell the rest of us what you had found, you wouldn't be able to, because your own radio signals traveling at the speed of light simply would not escape from the grip of the black hole. Nonetheless, we astronomers can detect black holes in space, and it works like this. If a black hole is, say, orbiting another star and tears material off of that star, as that material falls into the black hole and spirals around it, just before it falls in, it's going to get heated immensely by the great gravity of the black hole and by friction. And that immense heat often raises the temperature up to, you know, half a million or a million degrees. And anything that's that hot is going to emit X-rays. And it's in this way that astronomers have detected many of the black holes that we now know about. So Chandra, being an X-ray satellite, can locate yet more black holes in the universe in just that way, by looking for massive objects that are emitting X-rays.
Hmm. We have another caller waiting to talk with us. This caller is in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. I seem to have recalled that recently there was an article about the rate at which the universe is expanding, and astronomers were amazed that it seemed to be speeding up. Is that true, and if so, what would the significance of that be?
Oh, that's a very good question. Yeah, this is one of the hottest possible discoveries of the last 2 years. I say possible because the evidence is still very tentative, but it's very tantalizing. We had expected that the universe's expansion would actually not be speeding up, but slowing down. We've known ever since the 1920s, ever since Edwin Hubble's work, that the universe is expanding. And we've, of course, always known that the universe has matter, and matter has gravity. And you would expect the gravitational pull of all the matter in the universe to be slowing down the expansion rate of the universe. And that's, you know, for decades, that's what we astronomers thought we would see. And yet, in the last 2 years, there has emerged tentative evidence that the universe's expansion may actually be accelerating, not decelerating. And it's a real puzzle as to whether or not that really is true. But I think in the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to be seeing more observations that will either confirm or refute that tentative suggestion.
What would it mean with regard to the age of the universe if it's true?
If it is true, it would mean that the universe is older than we now think, because it would mean that in the past, the universe was expanding more slowly than we would otherwise think. Because if it's speeding up with time, that means in the past it was expanding more slowly, and therefore the time to the Big Bang would be longer than we would otherwise think. So, for example, that NASA team that reached an age of 12 billion years for the age of the universe, if the universe is actually accelerating, then that 12 billion would go up to maybe 13.5 billion.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Astronomer Ken Croswell is our guest this afternoon. The photographs from Hubble in Magnificent Universe have been enhanced by computer. I'm curious as to how that has changed them.
It hasn't changed them hugely. What I did was I had a master astrophotographer by the name of Tony Hallis digitally reprocess these images so that they remove small flaws in the Hubble Space Telescope camera. And so it's sort of like going from vinyl to CD. So it's not a huge effect, but it's nonetheless, you know, the photographs in Magnificent Universe are from Hubble are the best that you've ever seen them, just because they just stand out better than has ever been reproduced before. So, and my goal in producing Magnificent Universe was basically to select out the very best photographs of each celestial object. And so for the Hubble images, I wanted to make sure that they were at their absolute very best. And so I asked Tony to do all of the Hubble images for me.
Yeah, they're magnificent.
Thank you. Thank
yeah.
you.
Let's talk with another caller. On line one, another caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. I was wondering if everything's expanding, who gets more room? Like, will there be more room between the Earth and the Sun, or outside of our solar system, or where does the extra room go to?
Oh, good question. Actually, within the solar system, indeed, within the entire Milky Way galaxy, there is no expansion going on, because the Milky Way and the solar system are both held together by gravity, and the gravity more than overpowers the expansion of space. And in fact, the Milky Way itself belongs to a small group of galaxies called the Local Group. It contains about 35 galaxies. The best known, aside from the Milky Way, is Andromeda. And even within the Local Group of galaxies, the gravity of all those galaxies is able to overpower the expansion of space. So the answer to your question is that the expansion of space begins right outside the local group of galaxies. So that's maybe 2 or 3 million light years. And then we do see that nearly all galaxies are moving away from us.
So in between galaxies, that's where there's more room?
Well, it's basically between galaxy groups.
Oh,
the
okay.
local group is one group of 35 galaxies, and then there are other groups nearby. For example, the Sculptor group is like 6 or 7 million light years away, and the local group and the Sculptor group are moving away from each other.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Our next caller is on the toll-free line calling us from rural Oakland. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was wondering, how can the gravity of a black hole be greater than the star from which the black hole formed? Or is it the same amount of gravity just concentrated in an infinitely smaller space?
Exactly the latter. An excellent way to put it, yes. The gravity is the same. It's simply that when the star collapses, it compresses all that matter into a single point. And so the surface gravity, the gravity of the surface of the object is huge and so great that not even light, the fastest thing that we know about in the universe, can escape a black hole.
But then the attraction of the black hole for pulling other objects into it would remain essentially the same as it was when it was still a star, though.
That's exactly right. The difference, let's take the sun as an example. The sun will never become a black hole, but we could imagine compressing it so much that it did become a black hole. The difference between the sun and a black hole of the same mass is simply that if you landed on the sun and somehow survived, you could get off the sun. Whereas if you landed on a black hole with the sun's mass, you would go into the black hole and you'd never get back out again.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And a caller on line one in Champaign is waiting to talk with us. Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I was just puzzled by your use of language when you spoke of the Hubble telescope, and you said that when the Hubble wants to do something, I thought that the Hubble did what people wanted it to do, and when it didn't, it malfunctioned.
Well, of course, the Hubble Space Telescope is controlled from the ground, but
sure
in order for
is.
Us to point it at a particular object, we need those gyroscopes, and that's why this upcoming shuttle
right.
mission is so important.
Well, I just language like that, to me, I think, confuses young children and in particular, and they're learning, and it's good to watch that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Astronomer Ken Croswell is our guest this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. You said a moment ago to the caller in Oakland that the sun won't ever become a black hole.
That's right.
Why? Why not?
Well, the sun is just not massive enough to ever... in its evolution, become a black hole. We believe that black holes come from the most massive of stars, stars that actually explode when they die. Their outer layers shoot off into space, and then their inner core collapses and forms a black hole. And the sun just doesn't have nearly enough mass to go through that very dramatic phase of evolution. Instead, the sun, about 5-6 billion years from now, will expand into a red giant star and then shed its outer atmosphere rather gently, and then expose its core, which is actually very hot and quite dense, but not dense enough to be a black hole. And then the sun will become what's called a white dwarf star, which is a small star, not much bigger than the Earth, but extremely dense, so that a teaspoonful of matter from a white dwarf would actually weigh more than a ton.
Hmm. Would you tell us about sunspots? This is something that was really fascinating to think about, to learn about in looking at a magnificent universe. What causes them?
Well, sunspots are basically caused by their magnetic disturbances on the sun, and the sun's magnetic field goes through a cycle every 11 years, and every 11 years there are more sunspots. I mean, the sunspots wax and wane over a period of 11 years, and we're coming up right now on a sunspot maximum. Probably will occur in the next few months, in fact. And when that happens, there's the potential for more displays of northern lights, for example, and also possible disruption of communications here on Earth. And also, there seems to be evidence that the sun gets a bit warmer or a bit brighter when the number of sunspots increases, so that the Earth gets a bit warmer during sunspot maximum.
Yeah. You tell readers that for a good part of the 17th and 18th centuries, the spots vanished, or diminished anyway.
That's right.
Why did they vanish?
We don't know. We don't know. But it looks like other stars, like the Sun, occasionally do the same thing. And the reason that's so very important is because when the spots vanish altogether, it looks like the Sun actually fades a bit, and so the Earth cools. And in fact, that period was known as the Little Ice Age here on Earth because it was especially cold. For example, during the founding of the United States of America, it was especially cold here. And it was probably because the Sun was not quite as bright as it is today.
We've got another caller waiting to talk with us. Someone in the Lovington area on a mobile phone. Good afternoon.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. I got in the midst of your black hole discussion, so I guess I'm going backwards. But why won't everything eventually end up in a black hole? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Why won't everything eventually get swallowed by a black hole? Well, for one thing, the universe is expanding. And so material is moving away from other material. And furthermore, you know, things orbit other things. For example, the center of the very center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, actually does contain a massive black hole that has 2 to 3 million times more mass than the Sun. And the Sun and everything else in our galaxy is orbiting around that black hole. But that black hole isn't going to swallow us up. It's 27,000 light years away, and we're quite a safe distance away from it.
Interesting. Well, we were talking about the Sun, and the Sun, of course, is a star. And you write in the book, in the chapter on the stars, you say the story of the stars begins in the space between them. What's going on in that space between the stars?
Well, the space between the stars is actually the breeding ground of stars. The space between the stars contains beautiful gas and dust clouds. Photographs of which appear in the book, and you know these are absolutely gorgeous photographs of other other clouds. For example, the Horsehead Nebula, the Orion Nebula, the Lagoon Nebula. These are where stars are born as the gas and dust sort of conglomerate and give birth to new stars. And amazingly, when you look at those photographs, it may seem like those are really dense regions of the universe, but in fact, even the densest regions of them would pass for a perfect vacuum if transported back to Earth. And yet we owe our lives to that tenuous debris because the Sun and the Earth arose from it.
Also keeping the Earth warm, besides the Sun, volcanoes.
Yes, indeed. Most people don't appreciate the wonderful thing that the greenhouse effect is. Without the greenhouse effect on Earth, the Earth would be 60 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than it actually is. So instead of having a mean temperature of 60 degrees, it would have a mean temperature of 0 degrees Fahrenheit. And the entire Earth would be an ice-covered planet, possibly quite hostile to life. Volcanoes are especially important because they eject carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And carbon dioxide is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It traps the solar heat. And in fact, for the best example of the greenhouse effect, just go next door to the planet Venus, which has a massive carbon dioxide atmosphere and a surface temperature of 860 degrees Fahrenheit. Fortunately, we here on Earth have a much thinner carbon dioxide atmosphere, and the greenhouse effect is not nearly as bad. In addition to carbon dioxide, water vapor also plays a major role in raising the temperature of the Earth, so that altogether the greenhouse effect on Earth contributes about 60 degrees of warming to the planet.
The moon has played a role in breathing life into our planet. Would you explain?
Yeah, it certainly is possible because the moon, its gravity long ago, stirs the oceans, and it may have pushed life from the oceans where it arose onto the land. And even today, its gravity stabilizes the Earth's axial tilt and keeps it around 23.5 degrees. So that it doesn't have wild swings the way, for example, the planet Mars does. So it's conceivable that without the moon, we would not have life, or at least advanced life, on the Earth.
Speaking of Mars, there are indications, and I'm going to quote from your wonderful words here, that Mars was once a warm, wet world where life flowered. What evidence is there to suggest Mars was a place once where life flowered?
The best evidence comes from examination of the southern hemisphere of the Martian globe, where we actually see, billions of years ago, river channels carved into the Martian landscape. Now, today, Mars is a very hostile planet. It's very cold, very dry, very thin atmosphere. The atmosphere, in fact, at the surface of Mars is as thin as in the stratosphere of the Earth. But the fact that there was once water in liquid form flowing on the Martian surface indicates that Mars must have been warmer and wetter in the past. And one of the big questions we have concerning Mars is how much warmer and how much wetter was the planet? And why did it change from being a better place to being a worse place? Because, you know, we right now live on a very good planet, and we want to keep it that way. We don't want it to go bad the way Mars has done.
Yeah. How long ago might there have been life on Mars?
Oh, we're talking many billions of years ago. Certainly not recently. We're talking perhaps in the first billion years of Mars's history. So that would be 3.5 billion years ago.
Yeah. Boy, wouldn't you love to see fossils from Mars?
That would be one of the main goals of astronauts if they ever reached the surface of Mars, to look for fossils of life.
Yeah. What's the outlook for a mission to Mars, either manned or unmanned?
Well, lately the unmanned missions have not been doing terribly well. We lost the orbiter in September, and now it looks like we've lost the lander. This, of course, is very unfortunate. However, it does follow two very successful missions, the Mars Pathfinder, which landed on Mars in 1997. And, in fact, there's a wonderful photograph of the Martian surface from Mars Pathfinder in Magnificent Universe. And then the Mars Global Surveyor, which is still orbiting Mars and still sending back some wonderful data. We are planning to continue an intensive exploration of Mars through unmanned spacecraft. And then someday, we, of course, may send people to the planet Mars.
As late as the late 19th century, some astronomers believed that Mars had plants. What was the basis for that belief, for that theory?
Well, some people even thought there were intelligent beings on Mars. In particular, Percival Lowell thought he saw canals that the Martians had dug to carry water from the polar caps to the equator. But even after his work was pretty much criticized by other astronomers, many people thought there might be plants on Mars, and that's because there are actually regions of Mars that appear blue or green, and that suggested the presence of plants and maybe even some type of water on the surface of Mars. Today we know that those blue and green colors are actually illusions, that the overall color of Mars is basically orange and red, and when you're looking at Mars, the eye just gets starved for the opposite of those two colors, namely for blue and green, and so you perceive as blue or green anything that's not orange and red. So unfortunately, the hope that there might be plants on Mars is based on what we now know to be data that was an illusion.
Yeah. A group of astronomers reported last month that they have found 6 new planets. When you add these to 22 others discovered outside our solar system, that's 28. And most of these planets circle parent stars in oval-shaped orbits, and that's different from our solar system where we're in a circular orbit. Why is our orbit circular, and what accounts for those elliptical orbits of these planets that have been discovered recently?
Oh, those are good questions. Yeah, 10 years ago we didn't know of any planets outside of our solar system. Now we know of more planets outside the solar system than within, and most of the planets going around the sun, as you say, have fairly circular orbits. And it's a reasonable hypothesis that if they didn't have fairly circular orbits, we wouldn't be here. So, for example, if the planet Jupiter had a very elliptical orbit, its gravity would have actually ejected planets like the Earth completely out of the solar system and into the deep cold of space. And you can imagine life would not evolve under circumstances like that. Yet, many of these objects being discovered around other stars have highly elliptical orbits. Whether they're actually planets or something called brown dwarf stars is not yet determined, though. Scientists are debating among themselves how to classify many of these objects outside the solar system.
You write in the book, we owe our existence to a vast cascade of cosmic coincidences. Do you think that cascade of coincidences that has led to our being here on the planet Earth has led to the development of intelligent life somewhere else?
Oh, that's probably one of the most important questions we astronomers can attempt to answer. And I would bet the answer is probably yes, simply because there are so many planets and so many stars and so many galaxies out there, and it's kind of hard to conceive of, you know, a creator who would create such a huge and magnificent universe and be so incompetent that he was able to populate only one world with life. Nonetheless, I have to tell you that we have not yet discovered any signs of any form of life, intelligent or otherwise, outside of Earth. And so it's also possible that there may be no life anywhere else in the universe, that perhaps life is just such a complicated thing that it's only arisen once in this entire vast universe.
Or maybe it developed somewhere else, and like Mars, something happened.
That's certainly possible. There may be worlds where it has developed and actually perished. But if it's developed, see, if we can just find evidence that life either exists or has existed on just one other planet, then that would suggest that there must be, you know, zillions of worlds out there with life.
Yeah. Really wonderful questions to ponder, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Ken Croswell is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is Magnificent Universe. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have about 5 minutes left in this portion of The Afternoon Magazine, so if you'd like to join us with a question or comment, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Well, did you have a good seat for the Leonid meteor showers? It was disappointing, I understand, but there were some folks, I suppose, that had a good seat.
Well, we in the United States did not have good seats, unfortunately. But people in Europe and the Middle East actually did see a meteor storm. That is a storm of over 1,000 meteors per hour as the Earth hurtled through the debris shed by this comet, Temple Tuttle, that comes around every 33 years. The good news is that perhaps next year we in America might get a chance to see a meteor storm if the Leonids perform well, because we'll be in a better position than we were this year.
Interesting. Another caller waiting to talk with us on line one, a car phone. Good afternoon.
Hi. I've got a question that's pretty theoretical, but is there any possibility in the fabric of the universe that some of the expansion and such that you see could be, is it possible, like on a wave, if you had two objects on a wave, they might be closer or further apart depending upon where they were on the wave? Is there any possibility that there are, like, waves in the fabric of our universe?
I guess I don't understand what you mean by a wave.
Well, for instance, if you took a blanket and you know, wrinkled it, laid it out, but put wrinkles in it, and then if you kept that continually moving up and down, as things moved up and down, they might be closer at some points to each other than they were if they go into a flat area, and then as they go up over the wave, they're closer to each other. Am I making sense?
I see. And you think this may account for the observed expansion of the universe?
Yeah, I'm asking if there is any evidence that as we expand, I mean, are we just expanding out, or is there any rhythm or wave in the expansion? Or?
There does not seem to be any rhythm to the expansion. Everything, you know, as we go farther and farther out, we see things moving away from us faster and faster with higher and higher redshifts. So there's no sort of wave pattern within the universe that we can observe. But do keep in mind that we only observe, you know, out to 12 billion light years. That's about as far as we can see.
Yeah.
So who knows what's going on a trillion light years from here.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. In the 1990s, we saw some magnificent comets.
Oh, yes.
And
the two best are captured in Magnificent Universe.
Yeah. Are there any in our near future?
Not that we know of, but these things are unpredictable. You never, you know, Hale-Bopp was discovered just a year and a half before it made its spectacular appearance in 1997, and Comet Hyakutake, which appeared in 1996, was discovered just a few weeks before it made its wonderful appearance. And there are photographs of both of those comets, excellent photographs, full color, full page in Magnificent Universe. But the next comet, the next great comet, could be here, you know, within 2 months. We just don't know. These things are often discovered just before they pass close to the sun and the earth.
Hmm. Well, keep gazing skyward.
Yes. They, really great comets occur about once every 10 years, so we can hope for,
oh, okay,
for at least another one in the next 10 years.
Yeah, because we won't see Hale-Bopp. You and I won't ever again. And also with the other comet. The 1990s,
Japanese comet.
The
yeah.
Japanese comet.
Yeah, no, those guys are gone. They will be back someday, but long after we're gone.
Yeah, long after we're gone. Maybe we could close with you talking with us just a little bit here about meteors, which you say meteor flashes really miniature reenactments of Genesis.
Yes, yes, indeed. The Earth and the other planets form by basically things smashing into each other. And when we see a meteor, what we're really seeing is a bit of dust or a pebble that's approaching Earth and burning up in the atmosphere, maybe only partially burning up because part of that pebble may actually reach the surface of the Earth. So in a way, when we see a meteor, it's a reenactment of the formation of the entire Earth, which came about by a whole bunch of things basically smashing into each other and conglomerated into a planet.
Hmm. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
You're most welcome.
Our guest this afternoon has been astronomer Ken Croswell. His latest book is Magnificent Universe, and it is published by Simon & Schuster.